Hello and welcome to the Crossbox Podcast with new and improved audio. That's right, folks, we actually have two microphones. One, you will realize, for each of your hosts. That's me, Jay.
And me, John.
Yes, so this move to two microphones, which again, I should note, exactly matches the number of presenters we have.
This is big, folks.
Yeah, well, nothing like that, but we run our audio now through this piece of software called a mixer, which has plugins, which do things like stop the microphones from recording when there's not a lot of noise, which means like 80% fewer of Jay's obnoxious breathing sounds.
That's good, because Jay has an iron lung ever since that tragic accident at the Somme with...
It was the Fosgene. Yeah, yeah.
It's the worst.
as they say,
yeah. He's worse than Darth Vader.
Anyway, so there's also some other housekeeping stuff to get out of the way, besides that we have a proper microphone recording studio-ish setup now. So, before the news, every episode, we're now going to take a little bit of time to talk about something we like, which is, I realize, out of character for us, but we do like the way that it kind of sets the rest of us up, like the rest of the podcast up, to look more negative and therefore more edgy. Yeah. There's also, we've got some new topics in the rotation.
They're awesome.
They are. So, to date, it's always been guns, games, and defense, and those are classic Crossbox topics, and we are going to be sticking with those to some degree. We'll always have two of those three in any given episode. We may even have three of three, but in the case we don't, we will we'll talk about one of technology, books, or movies. Since, you know, those are also things that we do and enjoy.
A lot, like way too much probably, but that's okay.
And we figure that it's not unreasonable to talk about those too. And if you don't like that, well, we don't care. You're not making this show.
Nope.
So that does bring us up to the positivity segment.
That's right. Jay, what are you going to be positive about today?
Now, I have something in my notes, but I have to say we just had dinner and my wife made enchiladas. I've got to be pretty positive about those. Those are some really good enchiladas. A little bit of like spice to them, that creamy cream of chicken flavor. It's pretty fantastic.
So if you're in Swickley, come to Jay's apartment and ask for the enchiladas.
Yes. Or don't, because we won't let you in.
They don't know you, probably.
Yes, that's a good way to get shot.
Yep. Speaking of getting shot, nice segue, buddy.
Thank you.
Of course, I like Glocks a lot, and Glocks are great. They're cheap, reliable, common. The trigger is not the best, and there's lots of ways you can improve this. Lots of different kits out there, most of which tend to be expensive. However, there is the thing I want to talk to you about today, the Taran Tactical Innovations Grandmaster Trigger Kit. It is, of course, a set of springs, a reduced power striker spring, a reduced power drop plunger safety spring, and a increased power trigger return spring, along with the Taran version of the minus connector, which is better than the stock Glock one. And they combine to give a really nice, light, rolling brake trigger. Whole kit costs about $44, so it's really reasonably priced and a great way to get some stuff to play with.
Won't break the bank.
Exactly. Unlike, say, the $300 Zev kit. And I've put them all of those parts, into my Glock 34, which is on the table between us, and Jay will now give it a couple test dry fires. It's been cleared, safety Nazis. It's been cleared.
Yes, I actually objected it myself.
Yep.
And I'm also going to play with the light, the flashlight, because it's very bright.
Yep. 500 lumens. So he's going to give it a test and then see what he thinks.
You know, as Glock triggers go, that's pretty good.
Yeah. And now, again, it's $40 worth of improvements. It's a really nice, light, rolling brake. On a Gen 3, it's about 3.25 pounds at the very tip, which is like 5-something, where you actually pull it with your finger. It's about 0.5 pound heavier on a Gen 4 like that one. But really great rolling brake, lightweight, smooth. It's great. And again, for $40, you can play with the parts, figure out what works for you, what you don't like. The other cool thing, it comes with a little metal pin for the trigger housing in case you're doing a lot of stippling, so that you don't melt the plastic one.
Well, that's also very very nice, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah, I'm not using that right now because it's the stock texture, but, you know, it's in there. And the other nice thing with a $40 kit, you don't feel bad if you're not using all of it or if you end up mixing and matching with four other kits.
Right, you can go in and out some.
Exactly. And none of those mods, of course, are destructive in any way. You can go right back to stock if you want in, like, 30 seconds.
Well, brilliant. Especially there's a Glock, so like that complete strip does take about 30 seconds. Well, a couple of minutes. We timed it last episode.
Yeah, it's a couple of minutes. But it's very easy, and you don't have to worry about doing something stupid and unsafe and, you know, having it fire mysteriously in your holster. So, yeah, TTI Trigger Kit, it's great. Also, as ever, I'm not actually paid by TDI to say this, unfortunately. Terran Tactical Innovations, if you're listening.
Yeah, if you guys want to pay us, we'll totally talk up your stuff.
Oh, yeah. Will we ever? We'll even shoot it. Even Jay, who doesn't like Glocks, we'll shoot a TTI Glock for you.
I will find a reason to.
Yep. Well, you know, probably you guys. So, yeah. But as it is, that's a totally unpaid for, unsolicited feedback. It's freaking awesome.
I should say so.
Yep.
Anyway, I believe that about covers positivity, which takes us to the news. Now, I believe that that John's topic is more interesting. So, should we do that one first or leave it for second? What do
Let's
you think?
Let's do that one first.
All right. Well, I will count you down and get the music playing. So, in 3, 2, 1.
All right. I'm going to point out that this is recorded on March 3rd. So, this is before the official project announcement. However, sources tell me that Wilson Combat, 1911 custom manufacturer Sans Pareil, will be making a double stack 1911 in 9mm. This will be the hot new limited gun because, while only $3,000-ish, and that's kind of expensive, the Wilson 1911 will not, in fact, use the standard $140 custom-tuned, ridiculously sensitive to dirt magazines. No, it will use Beretta 92 magazines.
Beretta 92 magazines.
That's right, Beretta 92 magazines. The single stack sliding trigger of a 1911 with the double stack awesomeness of a more modern gun. Coming to you very soon.
Well, that's pretty fancy. You've got like 10 seconds left.
I do.
But we'll just... Oh, here.
Well, I really want one.
Done.
Don't you?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's my big product reveal. There'll be an article on the Soapbox probably up tonight.
Yeah.
I beat Wilson Combat to the punch with their own product release.
Nice. Well, that is exciting news. I do look forward to the Soapbox post, and we'll be playing that up this weekend, obviously. Yeah.
I should point out that's exciting for both of us. I like 1911s, 1911 triggers. Jay likes Beretta 92s.
I happen to have a reason to buy those magazines, in fact.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, that's what delightful news.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like I said, my piece of news isn't nearly as exciting or as exclusive.
But it has bigger global implications.
It does have bigger global implications. So, you want to count me down?
I'll count you down, Jay. 3, 2, 1, blast off.
All right. Speaking of blast off, our news is once again focused on SpaceX, the private space launch company. They have recently announced that they are flying two customers to the moon. Not to land on the moon, of course, because that's much harder, but around the moon. Which, I should note, puts them on the list of about, how many, like 12 Apollo missions, 10? However many Apollo missions there are, you are one of those people, one of that number of people who have been the furthest from this planet. What, 8? I say John, yeah, John, something with 8 fingers there to help me out. So you are in the top, you're in the top 10 for the furthest people from the surface of the Earth, which is pretty cool. Now, will SpaceX manage it? That is, of course, the question. All of the parts that are going to be used in this space launch mission are not currently, they haven't yet flown. So, I suppose what that means is we're going to have yet more news about SpaceX in the coming months as Falcon 9 Heavy and the Dragon capsule begin to fly. Boom. I'm going to have to make sure I get that boom timed right with the music in the in the end. So yeah, that about covers the news for today.
Yes, very exciting.
Well, I have to say, John was talking up the... he was talking this up in the pre-episode chit-chat, his news reveal. And I've got to say, it does live up to the hype somewhat.
I try. You know, I do work out...
From someone as big as Wilson Combat.
And exactly, yeah. Right? They know what they're doing. And I've long wondered why they didn't make a 2011, but this is even better. They also have quite a bit of experience working with Berettas, of course. If you're a fan of the Beretta 92 or the Beretta PX4, because that actually uses a bunch of the same parts, hit up Wilson Combat's website for fancy Beretta parts or send your Beretta 92 off to make it way more awesome.
Yep. Yet again, we are not paid to talk about this stuff.
No, again, Wilson Combat, if you want to sponsor us, we will totally shoot whatever you want to give us.
Exactly.
And say very nice things about it.
Yes, we are, we're very upfront about our desire to be sponsored for one and our willingness to talk nice about our sponsors, even if we should happen to fly in the face of fact, which between both TTI and Wilson Combat. It does not.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome people.
They are good products before you pay us to say they are. But if you didn't want to pay us to say that you're, you know, even better products, we would do that.
Oh, yeah, we'll do that. We are shields for hire.
Yes, please do. Next on Soapbox Unfiltered Opinions.
That's right.
We have our defense topic for the evening.
That's right. Yeah. Unfiltered and unpaid for. Thank you very much, Lockheed Martin, who still hasn't taken us up on our generous offer of paying for our saying nice things about them. But don't worry that we're not talking about them tonight.
Yes. For once, actually, we don't have anything to make fun of. Anything to make fun of Lockheed for.
Nope.
Well, so we got to thinking. We've kind of had a bit of a grab bag already, right? We had the grab bag introduction topics. We have the positivity and news segments, which are by nature grab bags. And we figured we'd kind of play that up for the rest of the night. So we have a little grab bag in our defense topic of movement problems for you. That is to say, there are sometimes tactical problems relating to movement. And
they're often. That's a big problem.
That's a fair point. There are usually tactical problems related to movement.
Mm-hmm.
And our aim is to bring you an interesting slice of solutions to some of those problems. Now, there are, in the world of tactics, or in the world of tactics and doctrine, there is such a thing as good doctrine and bad doctrine. I think this is an uncontroversial statement. Now, to those good and bad doctrines, there are also good and bad solutions, which means that you can have a good solution which follows a poor doctrine.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of a, you some stupidity got you in this mess, but you came up with a good answer, all things considered.
Well, you came up with a good answer, or even though it's not a great product taken in the historical sense, even if with the benefit of hindsight, we can say that wasn't really a very good idea. It was at least good at the role at which it was designed to do, whether or not that role was stupid.
Exactly.
Yes.
And then now, sometimes, like, everything is just stupid and you suck.
Right.
Go play in traffic.
And so, in the interests of fairness and coming up with something to fit the grab bag theme, we decided we would have a look at four different things, one from each corner of the four quadrant shape which I've described. You've got something with a good solution to a good problem that arises from good doctrine, a good solution to a problem that arises from bad doctrine, and so on and so forth, the other two.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe the first one on the list, John, is
yeah, that would be me, mostly, because it's, of course, armored fighting vehicles, which is a passion of mine. And we're going to talk about the Tiger I, the Panzerkampfwagen 6, Mark I Tiger. It's a really neat tank. It's, of course, the first of the heavy tanks, or one of the first of the heavy tanks. So it's bigger, it's heavier, it's got more armor, it's got a terrifying 88mm gun. It has an engine that isn't quite up to the job of moving it, but this bigger, but again, this isn't Tiger II sluggish. This is still
moderately
legit.
Mobile for a World War II tank.
It works. It moves a little slower, but you're heavier and you can kill better. But it's also not, you know, a snail.
Right.
But a much bigger tank than previous World War II tanks, especially previous World War II German tanks, they tend to be light up until you get like the Panther and the Tiger, didn't have problems with ground pressure. And so this was a new problem for the crew. And what the Germans came up with was a wonderful little manual with some lovely, voluptuous women wearing revealing outfits, so you'd remember what they were telling you. And they came up with the following solution. Your Tiger tank is very heavy. To determine whether or not it is safe to cross some ground, get out of the tank, have your buddy climb up on your back, you know, piggyback style, we would call it in the United States, and then stand on one foot. If you sink into the ground, your Tiger tank will sink into the ground. If you do not, it is safe to drive. It's a really simple thing you do in the field, especially considering the Tiger has five guys in it, and there's probably some Panzer Grenadiers around with nothing better to do.
You can spare some people to go out and stand on one foot in the field.
Exactly. You know, it doesn't require any special tools, doesn't require any special knowledge. It's pretty simple to remember, and it's very effective. So you have a new tank that requires you to think a little differently about movement. You're not going to scrap the tank because of that. You're going to come up with a really simple field expedient solution, and you're going to present it in a really clever way.
Well, there you have it.
Yep. You should also note that idea of the presentation of buxom women telling people important things would come up again and again. There's a wonderful M16 manual out there with some attractive women in scanty army-ish uniforms telling you how to take care of your
army-ish.
M16.
Yeah.
Army-ish. Well, you know, somehow I don't think it's uniform. It's regulation on the uniform to have like two buttons in the middle of your chest somewhere.
that kind of V-neck is a Not regulation.
No, not that I'm going to complain, but it's not regulation.
So there we have our good doctrine and a good solution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we'll continue to dip. Actually, I believe we dip into the World War II well pretty heavily in this grab bag, since all of our topics are, in fact, World War II focused.
Oh, come on.
But this one is at least...
great patriotic war, Jay.
This one does at least start before the war.
Yep.
You see, in the 1930s, or as well, like the 1920s and 1930s, you, the American aircraft carrier designer, had a problem. See, it's desired that you should be able to occasionally launch a scout by itself or something, you know, launch some plane on its own, you know, over the deck, and then without launching the rest of your planes, you want to recover that. Now, if you're familiar with modern aircraft carriers, you realize this is quite straightforward, but it turns out that since the angled flight deck, you may recall, was invented in the late 50s.
By the British.
Yeah.
You don't have that. You have a straight deck.
That luxury. What you have, since you're an American carrier designer, is at the back of the aircraft carrier's deck, you have all of your aircraft parked, because your hangar is not large enough really to accommodate all of them in their fully assembled form. That's the way that they decided to do things.
Yep. More planes is better.
More planes is better. It's easier to put them on the deck, and you can build a smaller hangar, and it's easier. So, with that in mind, you have a couple of... you see the problem now. When you want to land, say, over the stern of an aircraft carrier, and there are a bunch of airplanes there, that's not a good situation. You could try landing further forward, but that seems awfully fraught with error, and you have very little room to try the go-around if you miss it, or if the cable snaps on you.
Right, and if you screw up your approach, where normally you'd be able to correct and say, oh no, I'm a little too low, those planes
parked on
the deck.
All those other planes, yeah.
And catch fire and die.
And then so would everyone else, because you hit all these planes, which are, you know, flammable even if they're not loaded with fuel and bombs. And, you know, they might well be, especially if you're launching a scout, which is then coming back.
Right.
So what did the Americans do? Well, they thought to themselves, well, it's a pretty fine lined hull. What if we just make it go backwards? And this is what they did. It's difficult to run a steam turbine backwards because you've got a bunch of stages in this turbine which are made to work at a certain pressure. And if you're running it backwards, then that pressure gradient is completely reversed. And that's hard on the blades and the stators and all the turbiney bits.
Yep. So, I mean, not a problem on Lexington or Saratoga because they had a turboelectric drive and you can just reverse the polarity.
But that was because they were built as battle cruisers originally. And
We like turboelectrics.
So what you have is really a crazy sight. You have these aircraft carriers going backwards at, you know, 22 knots so they can land aircraft over the bow as opposed to, you know, putting the aircraft, the other aircraft in the hangar or really anything.
Moving them
forward. Well, there's a lot of them moving them's hard. That's pretty much a no-go.
Up.
Yeah.
Baby.
So, if you happen to read Norman Friedman's U.S. Aircraft Carrier Design book, which I believe is at the bottom of the bottom of the stack of books, which is making up John's microphone stand or a couple up. Anyway, you will see a picture, I believe, of Ranger running backwards at 20 some knots, recovering an aircraft over the bow. Now, of course, this is a problem that arises from good doctrine, in that you want to be able to do more than just launch a deckload strike. But I think it's really not a very good solution.
No.
Yeah.
Also, we should point out that the idea of more airplanes on an aircraft carrier is also a really good idea. It made American carriers really formidable because they had so many freaking planes. More really is better.
It's true. So, I believe the next one on the list is also mine, and that is a bad doctrine with a good solution.
That's right.
Now, the British, I suppose, was it just the British?
Mostly the British.
The British and kind of maybe the French.
Yeah, the French are weird when you talk about tanks, but that's a story for another time. We're talking about the British today.
So the British had this tank doctrine in the years leading up to World War II. You have your cruiser tanks, which is to say tanks which... in the cruise in the naval sense of the word, you know, seeking action with the enemy. And you have your infantry tanks, which are more or less like assault guns you would find in anyone else's military.
Right.
So, this is not a great idea, again, because what you end up with is, well, we've got, you know, 1,100 tanks. That's more than enough. But, you know, 600 of them are these enormous, slow, heavily armored, but slow and immobile things that have, rather than a real tank gun, a little, you know, piddly HE hurler.
Right. And remember, at this time, high explosive, of course, was the round of choice for destroying things, and that doesn't require a lot of barrel length.
Right.
But to destroy a tank, you'd want an armor-piercing round, which would have a solid core, and it required velocity, which means barrel length.
Yep.
So you can't readily switch between the two. If the gun wasn't designed for it, it won't work.
Right. So the infantry tank, it turns out, was not a very good idea.
No.
In almost every case where we would want that sort of vehicle, an assault gun with, you know, like nice fixed frontal armor and a big HE gun in the front works just as well.
And you don't even need the turret. Look at the Stug 3.
Yeah, exactly. That's more or less what I'm saying. The removing the turret removes a lot of complexity and a lot of cost, and you get a cheaper vehicle that does what you want it to do. It's just as capable in its intended role, because it doesn't have to be especially mobile or shoot at things to its sides or behind it very often. And it's much more straightforward to build, and it doesn't rob you of a paper tank strength, I guess, which is what I'm trying to say.
Also, when the commander sees it, he intuitively knows that's different from a tank.
Right. This is for shooting these big, you know, 5-inch shells and things, not for poking holes in, you know, 110 millimeters of German steel plate.
Lousy Germans.
Yeah. So, although the infantry tank was a bad idea, I think history bears this out, it was an objectively bad idea. The Matilda, the British infantry tank, mostly of the pre-war and war years, was actually a pretty good take on it.
Yeah, as far as tanks go, they were formidable. They were very hard to knock out.
Right, they were slow and heavily armored. So, I mean, they weren't great in the kind of wide open tank battles you saw in North Africa.
I mean, they weren't great there because they were slow. And because they couldn't kill tanks. But you can see in North Africa, and actually especially in the campaigns in France in 1940, the Matilda tank was annoyingly hard to kill, the Germans said.
Right. It's a good, like, kind of... It's kind of a breakthrough thing, almost. You can just kind of drive it forward and follow it in. And that's not a bad role, but it's not what it was designed to do. It turns out that it... although it was functional in a role that was not its original design role... I feel like it could have been more functional if it had taken the realities of warfare into account a little bit better.
Right. It was also, it's kind of a very World War One level thinking here, right?
Well, yeah, you've got, we're going to attach these tanks to the infantry, then we're going to roll forward over the enemy's trenches, what?
Ha, yes. Right, exactly, and we'll blow up all their stupid barbed wire and stupid machine
pillboxes
gun boxes.
And whatnot. Yes.
Yep.
We'll never put a machine gun position where we can sit with our infantry tank, yes? Yes. Hmm.
Yep. And, you know, all those pesky artillery batteries you can also blow up, because no one would think to arm an artillery battery.
Exactly.
No one.
Never.
It's inconceivable.
Or make it, you know, self-mobile.
Right. Or make it kill other tanks that we've had since the last war. No.
Piffle. Bosh.
Well, let's get to our bad doctrine, bad solution. This is where it's at. Stupid ideas executed stupidly.
Stupid ideas and stupid execution.
That's right. They're too stupid to have a good time. And who's too stupid to have a good time? The Fallschirmjäger.
It's
they're
the truth.
They're too stupid to have a good time. And why is that? Because their parachute design was just mind-bogglingly dumb.
Terrible. I'm shaking my head in front of my microphone.
Yeah, you can't
right
see
now.
That. But it's just... So when you think a parachute, you're probably thinking to yourself, well, gee... That's not something that's all that hard to design, right? I mean,
you make a harness, like it goes over a guy's shoulders, right?
Like kind of like a backpack.
But that's where you're wrong.
Kind of like a backpack, right? Because that's something I have, or I guess if it's World War II, and knapsack.
Yeah.
And you kind of, right, that's kind of comfortable in a way to support weight, and you attach the parachute to that, right? But no. No, you don't
that. You build a backpack, but then you attach it, rather than at the top of the shoulders where you'd expect, because that's kind of, you know, where a harness usually attaches, you attach it in the center of the back, because that's totally what you think of when you think, I want something to support a person's weight. How should I do this?
Yep. Center of his back, so he swings about like some kind of pinata.
Right. And as I'm sure John is about to say, this turned out to be a really bad idea in practice.
Yeah. Gee, when I'm falling from an airplane, maybe I'd want to be stable. Maybe I'd want my feet pointed at the ground so I can enter the parachute landing fall like a smart person.
Yeah.
So I don't have broken freaking bones.
Well, yeah, all these things that that you can do with a regular parachute, you can't do with this. For instance, it's difficult to carry a rifle with you because the place where you would sling it is taken up by the parachute harness.
That's right.
And if you put it in front of you, then you might fall on it because you can't control your fall because you're falling face first.
Exactly. Yeah. Right? So where the American paratroopers, like my grandfather, could carry a small weapon in a bag, kind of like right next to you in front, which was convenient enough as long as you were careful not to fall on that.
Yeah, and like it's there, so you know it's there.
You can right, just yeah, you can just kind of push it out of the way direction. And yeah. Parachute landing fall in another direction, which is great. So what you ended up with the Germans, because you would fall on your gun, which would be bad. Remember, these are not soft parachutes, soft modern parachutes, okay? These are wartime expedient parachutes.
You're landing hard.
Yeah. If you land on something that's made of metal and wood, like, I don't know, any gun in World War II, that's going to break some ribs. Broken ribs really sucks.
Yeah, and that's it really degrades the combat efficiency of the unit if everyone has like
breathe,
two broken ribs.
It hurts. Your ribs are stabbing you in the lungs. It sucks. And so what the Germans then said was, oh, we'll drop our weapons separately from
these
the
little canisters. Yeah.
Yes. Because we're totally able to control where the paratroopers and the canisters fall. And whereas
to make them fall in the exact same place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that'll work great, right? And whereas everybody else pretty soon discovered that, hey, you know, paratroopers need to have weapons when they land.
Armaments, like, yes.
Yeah, like not just a pistol, like submachine guns and rifles and shit. The Germans, they can't, you know, you just can't. You parachute into Crete, and, well, the Minotaur ate all your frickin' guns or something.
Yep. And it turns out, I mean, even though Crete was a success for the German paratroopers, more or less, like, they did achieve their strategic objective.
Yeah.
They did so with vastly greater casualties than they had to. Yep. Operational losses, because, again, falling on your face with a parachute is not super pleasant.
No.
And this, like, say you're falling at 10 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And you don't get to use your, you know, legs, these nice, springy, well-designed things that are made to take impact.
That's right.
You just fall on your face.
Yep.
And to add insult to very probable injury, all you have is, you know, the little Luger or Walther that they decided to issue you.
Yeah.
While you go in search of your actual gun.
Right, and you're looking for your actual gun, hoping you don't run into some terrifying New Zealand Maori or something who probably wants to eat your face.
Yeah, like the twin Kukri sort of.
Yeah, exactly, right? You know, those guys are scary. Have you seen a haka?
Or indeed, just a guy with a rifle.
Exactly. He's got you. The jig is up, Jerry, because he's got a rifle and you don't. You probably have some stupid, like, overly complicated leather retention harness because you fell out of a plane and these are Germans. Have you ever known them design anything simple?
Not really, no.
No, yeah. No. Needless complications the order of the day. So it was a terrible idea. And after Crete, the Germans basically abandoned the idea of paratroopers, even though America and Britain would keep using them and keep having generally success with them, with the notable exception of a certain brigade in Arnhem.
Yes.
But that's for another story.
Yes. Another topic, in fact.
Yeah.
Well, that does wrap up our defense grab bag, which brings us on to our games grab bag.
Yeah.
And this one is fascinating. We decided that rather than talk about a specific game, as we've done in the past, we would talk about features we find across games. That is to say, things that you find in a lot of games of a certain genre, or indeed a lot of games, that are designed exceptionally well, or exceptionally poorly, I suppose, in some cases.
Right.
So, I'll kick things off, I guess, with the Humble Minimap. It is
a map, but smaller?
Yes. It's one of the most iconic little features in gaming, I would say. I mean, if you've got a game that has some sort of top-down viewpoint, you almost certainly have a mini-map. And it turns out this isn't actually as old as the world of top-down gaming. The first mini-map I could find in a game was in Railroad Tycoon, which was released in 1990, which is, I mean, it's old, but it's not as old as it could be.
It's not as old as you are.
Yeah. That's not terribly old, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Of course not.
So yeah, and it's been going strong ever since then, because it does serve a useful purpose. It conveys information that you can't ordinarily get, which is the state of the entire map, or at least the shape of the entire map.
Right.
In a fairly easy to reference form. So you've got that, like, that situational awareness bonus. You have some at-a-glance information, and ordinarily you can click on that and move around the map.
That's right.
Of course, I don't need to
keep an idea, an eye on everything while focusing on something of local interest.
Of course, I don't necessarily need to describe a mini-map to all of you, our dear listeners, but I did anyway, because, you know, I need to fill some time with this. Yeah.
Yep.
So, let's take a look at some games that did it either exceptionally well or exceptionally poorly.
We're going to start positive?
We are going to start positive. We're going to start with Supreme Commander.
Oh boy, this is still my beating heart.
Yeah, one of the first games I believe I bought for like proving a system that I had just built. Because when it released, it was something of a behemoth, a titan almost in terms of system requirements.
Yep.
And it was, of course, a great deal of fun. I believe it's still one of the best real-time strategy games ever made.
Yep.
And the thing is, it didn't have a mini-map. I mean, not exactly. So Supreme Commander's shtick was that you could, you know, use your scroll wheel and go all the way in and then see all these lovingly rendered units in beautiful 3D graphics with all kinds of fancy particle effects. I mean, this is about like the mid to late 2000s. So count your rivets, view in. But then if you moved your scroll wheel in the other direction, you would zoom all the way out and out and out. And eventually your units, rather than being little graphical things, are replaced by tiles, tokens, NATO counters.
Exactly.
The sort of thing that wargamers like me, you know, that makes our heartbeat a little bit faster. So there really wasn't any particular need for a minimap, because if you wanted to get a good strategic overview of the game, you could just scroll all the way out, and suddenly you can see the whole map, and everything that you can see, everything that you have visibility on, is revealed in that zoomed-out view with the handy counters to make it all readable. But it did have a sort of a map-within-a-map feature. You could make a frame that was minimap-sized, and then you could use that as a separate map. You could zoom it in and out as you desired. It was basically just a window on a second part of the map besides what your main screen was looking at, which is handy. You can either leave it zoomed out and get that same overall picture, or you can zoom in on some important, you know, bottleneck or choke point in the fight and keep tabs on that, which, because Supreme Commander is pretty much a game of information, which one of the good things about it, I would say.
Yeah.
It's a lot of it's about divining what your opponent is aiming to do and working out ways to counter that. The actual combat, there's not a ton of micromanagement in the tradition of other real-time strategy games I won't mention by name.
I will. StarCraft.
Well, there you go. One of us did it.
I'm rolling. You can't see my eyes right now, but they're rolling at the notion of StarCraft as a strategy game.
They are rolling. StarCraft's like a tactics micromanagement, whatever.
Yeah.
But strategy made more sense at the time as a marketing label, so there you go. But since Supreme Commander is a game about information, the fact that you have not just one window that gives you a lot of information, but two windows that you can use independently was I believe that was the first time that was really done.
And actually something else that came out about that time, which you, our listeners, might be familiar with as well, picture-in-picture on your television set. Do you have two games you want to watch? You know, you can put one in like a little inset view and kind of keep an eye on what's going on with that stupid rival to your team while you also watch your team play. And you can switch between the two if something important is happening.
So, and you have the gaming equivalent of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's great. It worked really well.
It was brilliant.
Super handy.
Yeah.
Which, of course, meant that everyone copied it, right?
No. Wrong. I believe I haven't seen it since.
Nope.
Even games in the same genre, like Planetary Annihilation and Ashes of the Singularity, I don't believe they do that same sort of feature where you have the option to look at two parts of the map at once.
Yeah.
It is, of course, graphically demanding because you have two maps, like two viewports to render at the same time. But, I mean,
buy a better computer.
We have all these
babies.
Fancy computers. We can manage that. And I feel like we should have.
Yep.
Next up, we have a...
Just bring that up in a second. We've also hit, like, I want to hit that computer thing a bit. Not to go too much in the hardware, but we're kind of plateau-y right now.
Right.
Where not a lot of games are really pushing graphics cards or CPUs, unless you're trying to do something crazy in 3D. Or multiple, like, 4K displays. So, again, I don't see why this can't be a thing.
Well, exactly.
We have the power to spare.
Let's do it. Yeah.
Now let's talk about the bad. Who did this? Who made mini maps that suck?
Well, let's talk about Diablo and a lot of games that share
Diablo's
heritage.
We really hate Blizzard, don't we?
Yeah, I guess we're kind of in that mood. That said, even games companies that I rather like Grunic Games, the which was at the time headed by the inestimable Travis Baldry, had the same sort of mini map, which I'm about to talk about. So in Diablo and games which share its heritage, you are an adventurer running through a dungeon, hacking and slashing everything that moves. The so-called hack and slash adventure genre. And it is a lot of fun.
Yep.
The thing is, though, you're running through a dungeon that is in a lot of cases procedurally generated. And what that means is not very memorable in any particular spot. So you can't navigate in the way you can in other games. You can't get a good sense of the map where the landmarks are because, number one, you're moving around a lot between maps, which may look an awful lot alike, and number two, in a lot of those maps, which look a lot alike, there are rooms which follow the same patterns that you've seen before. And yeah. So you can never really get a good mental picture of
I've
where
you
are.
I've seen that ruined statue before. Oh, yeah, in like every other room that I've been playing on this session.
So Blizzard, back in the day, decided that the way to fix this would be to give you a full screen overlay, which seems like an elegant solution at first. You have a map of the dungeon, which kind of fills in as you explore.
Right. And it's superimposed over
It's
what
superimposed
you have.
Over what you have in like a nice lightweight way, so you can't it's not too in the way. But it turns out that it actually is really in the way, and what you end up doing is playing a game about watching a map as opposed to playing a game about beating things up, well, punching them until they drop their loot.
Yep.
And that's no good. The minimap in its best form is a feature that gives you more information without being in the way.
Right. Still lets you play what you came here to play, which wasn't stare at a map all day.
Right. We aren't playing stare at a map 2. We're playing Diablo 2 or Torchlight or Torchlight 2. Well, maybe I recommend the Torchlight games regardless.
Yes. But the Torchlight games are awesome and we love them.
But the map is not a great feature.
No.
I've got another bad one too, actually.
All right. Keep going.
I think it's because it's much easier to do this poorly than just do it well, it turns out.
That's okay, though. It doesn't matter.
This is getting a little bit, perhaps, further away from the true idea of the minimap. But in almost every case in which you play a space combat game, you'll find that the sensor display is absolutely terrible.
You mean a space trading game?
No, or a space combat game.
But there's no combat in them.
I mean, there was in X-Wing Alliance.
So. Yeah, that's true. I suppose that one had combat and very little trading.
Although, actually, I do have better things to say about that sensor than I do about the... So anyway, the problem with trying to build a sensor display for your 3D combat space trading game is that you're trying to map relative positions in 3D coordinates onto a two-dimensional screen. Onto a two-dimensional screen in the cockpit of a ship that is displayed on a two-dimensional screen.
Right.
It doesn't make it any worse, but it does sound good to get two-dimensional in that many times.
That's a lot of two-dimensional,
Jay. And that's hard. You may have noticed in your daily life that it's actually not really super easy to tell, to get fine distinctions in depth correct in every case. And it's much harder when you have is a flat plane with dots above and below it connected by lines. What you get is a cluttered mess. You can't do anything. You can't actually read any useful information off of. I did mention that I do actually kind of like the X-Wing series solution to that. I believe Wing Commander used something similar. Where rather than trying to get range information as well, all you have is bearing. You have a screen representing your forward hemisphere and a screen representing your aft hemisphere, and you have dots that show you at what angles things are.
Right, and then they can do above and below by hemisphere, and since they have two screens, they give you front and back without having to do the little, conventional top-down bird's-eye view radar display. The plan position indicator, I think the technical term is. Mm-hmm. So this actually works quite well.
See, the front and back gives you the information you need in combat, which is to say, where is that guy who just flew above my cockpit?
Yep.
And it's easy to read because it's exactly, the front one is exactly what you see in front of you, except you get the fisheye view, and the aft one is the mirror of that.
Yep.
It's straightforward, it makes sense, and it's a good solution.
Yep.
And really, I think the classic RTS minimap, the kind you're thinking of when I say the words minimap, the little
Command
map in the
encounter.
Corner. Yeah. Dune 2, if you want to get super old school.
Oh, Dune.
Yeah. But yeah, so like the classic RTS minimap with the plan display of the landscape and then little dots showing where things are. I don't think even that's a very good solution. We live in a world where Supreme Commander was a thing, and Supreme Commander's solution was excellent. And I believe, as John said, we have the horsepower. Let's just do that instead.
Right. And also, let's point out, because I'm actually a pretty big fan historically of the Command & Conquer games, at least the good old ones with the full motion video cutscenes that were cheesetacular. Even though you have the minimap, that basically really only assisted you in moving the camera faster. If your base was under attack while you were off doing something else, there was a little computer voice that said, "Your base is under attack. Your base is under attack." Because you couldn't tell from the stupid little minimap.
Right.
Now, I will cut Westwood some slack, mostly because that was the 90s and we didn't have the power. But as Jay said, we have the technology. Let's rebuild it.
Better, stronger, faster. Well, yeah.
If we can do it for only $6 million, it'd be awesome.
That would be great. I mean, unfortunately, game budgets are getting above that nowadays.
What if we just say it's $6 million, $1960?
I'm going to make that work. As long as you've got to just pick the right baseline of your budget, problems all go away.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's so much better at the shareholder meetings if I just change the axes and lie through my teeth.
Exactly. So I believe that brings us to your...
Yeah, we still got time for this?
I think we do.
Awesome. All right, so I'm a big shooter fan. And let's talk about health. Health systems. And really, it's not so much the system. It's how do you get health back? You're shot. Now, in the real world, this means that you're going to be taking a trip to a level one trauma center in the back of an ambulance, and you're probably going to be saying a prayer to whatever deity you believe in. Yes, even if you're an atheist, you'll find one to believe in. You're shot. But in a video game, of course, that's not very fun and results in massive amounts of downtime in a hospital, which is also not fun. And since avoiding sepsis is not, in fact, a game that anyone wants to play ever, game designers have come up with other things. The classic... old school version is the health pack, and this works pretty well. You have a health pack, you can use it in nicer games, you can carry them and use them when you want as opposed to running over them. Yeah. The problem is with health packs is that this, well, I suppose there was a disconnect at some point. Somebody started complaining this quote unquote wasn't realistic. Okay, but it's a game. And two, this requires a lot of work on the designer part to place them in adequate places.
To know where the health packs need to go to make the game playable.
Right. And because some games can get harder or easier just by how many health packs there are. So around the early 2000s, we started seeing regenerating health. Now, the first Halo game has both regenerating health and health packs, but regenerating health quickly became the thing. I heard a lot of people say it was more realistic. This is bullshit, at least in any time span that matters.
I think the usual scenario there, though, what they're saying is it's not that your health is coming back like there. It's that they weren't actually hitting you in the first place. You're just being driven behind cover in greater and greater fear. And eventually, I guess you die from the fear, but whatever.
Yeah, okay. You're dying from the fear, not the fact that your screen is red and you can't see anyone. Which is something I hate about regenerating health is that they always come with a system where your screen is impossible to see through. So you can't shoot the guy who's shooting you. You have to hide. And then the problem has now become that there's a hidden challenge, which is balancing that health regen timer. But any way you cut it, it fundamentally is slowing. It is draining. It is painful. It makes you wait. Which really puts a damper on your fun, because the fun part isn't waiting. The fun part isn't standing behind some convenient random waist-high cover, which is super realistic, and waiting for the screen to become visible again.
Just making me think of my exploits in the Uncharted series.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. The fun part
is... I'm going to hide behind this pillar until my screen turns less black and white. Then I'm going to pop out and take these three shots. Then I'm going to duck back behind cover because that makes me feel like an adventurer.
Exactly, right? The fun...
I guess,
you never see Indiana Jones do that.
Nathan Drake's a bit of a wimp compared to Indiana Jones.
Apparently, so, yeah. He's a freaking pussy. Well, Modern men need to harden the fuck up.
I think that characterization is accurate either way. He's a bit of a...
Yeah, yeah. There's also other story things where, like, he apparently can't tell his wife things somehow. And I don't know how you marry someone and then get to that point. But whatever. Nathan Drake's relationship problems are not our problem. What I really liked was a couple different approaches to this that are more modern. Max Payne 3, one of my favorite games, brought health packs back in a fun way. They basically made sure there were plenty on the map. The enemies deal tons of damage, so if you're stupid, you'll die anyway. And one of the fun things with the health packs is in the game, the health packs are represented as a bottle of painkillers. Because Max, like a ton of, well, probably unfortunately, actual former police officers, is a painkiller addict, among other things. So he pops his painkillers, and yeah, the pain goes away, and your health is restored. But the screen gets all wobbly and woozy because, you know, you just chugged a whole bottle of Vicodin, you idiot. This is not the doctor's recommended dose. And so it's really fun to pop the pills and keep fighting and kind of have to deal with the screen getting all confusing for a little bit. It adds a neat little flavor to it. And it means I can keep going. Of course, the thing here, this is a pretty traditional kind of change. They just brought it back. It was fun because they had a well-constructed health pack system. The other one I want to bring up is Doom. And Doom was creative because what Doom did, the new Doom, 2016 Doom, they said, you know what, anything we do, health packs make you backtrack and look for health. Regenerating health is stupid. It makes you seek cover like a little baby and cry in the corner until your health comes back. We want you to be a badass. We want you to be an action hero. And so to get your health back, you have to run up to a demon and punch it in the face.
That totally makes me think I'm feeling more healthy.
Exactly, right? Well, this is Mike Tyson, right? Everybody has a plan, even demons. Demons have a plan for you until you punch them in the mouth. That's Mike Tyson, book 4, chapter 4, verse 17 in the Book of Tyson. And it's just lots of fun to run up to a demon and beat on him or take a chainsaw to his face and then watch health drop out. And it encourages you to be aggressive and to think, I'm in trouble, I need to attack more. This is great, like World War I thinking with a land vital, right? You know, where you have Marshal Foch saying, you know, I'm outflanked. Yeah, the right wing is falling back. The center is collapsing. The left wing is encircled. Situation excellent. I shall attack.
Yep.
This is what we want in a game where you're the ultimate. This may not be, you know, the best idea in, you know, the sum or, you know, in 1914. But when you're telling me that I'm an intergalactic badass who is fighting demons and is expected to win, I want to feel like I'm this awesome. I want to feel like Rambo or John McClane or one of these awesome action hero stars. John Wick. He doesn't hide in the corner. He jumps and attacks these guys and shoots them in the face repeatedly, and it's awesome.
Keeps on keeping on.
So that's really what I think is some of the better ones. I found that often the, in terms of bad, I find that regenerating health is pretty susceptible to turning into the annoying bad just because of that timer. If it's a little off, you'll get really, really frustrated. And often, if you're replaying a game on a higher difficulty level, this is something they'll throw at you to make your life suck and make their lives easier so they don't have to actually think of how to make it genuinely harder. So, like, Halo 2 Legendary is pretty awful with, like, how quickly your health bar goes away and how long you have to sit and cover and wait and hope that some elite doesn't, like, run around the corner and stab you with a plasma knife.
I mean, this is a... And this Halo is even a particularly bad offender there because the hiding behind cover is not even very interesting. You're just kind of like standing there.
Yep. Yeah, there's no cover system. You're just jumping behind
cover. This isn't
a
cool, like mid or late 2000s, early 2010s action game. This is a lame mid 2000s action game where you've got to just stand there and not be in the cover properly.
Right, exactly. And that kind of cover worked in the 90s when, well, one, we had simpler games, and two, you duck behind cover to reload and use a health pack and then pop back out again. And so you're only there for like a couple seconds, then you pop back out. The other fun thing I like about Doom, and this is getting away from myself, was that it doesn't have, you know, magazines, you know. The gun has ammo or it doesn't. And if it has ammo, shoot people with it.
That's it's a very old school setup.
But it's cool. And again, every game shouldn't do this, but Doom and Max Payne bringing a lot of fun old school things back in a nicely well done way is a great way to distinguish your game from a lot of, you know, shitty Call of Duty clones. So, you know, Max Payne had really cool bullet time with slow motion matrixy stuff and, you know, retro health packs that also kind of mess with you a bit, which for just temporarily, but it was a fun little twist on, hey, this is a nicely set up, you know, modern take on the classic health pack. So yeah, that's where I'm coming from on health systems and regen. I'm still kind of annoyed about regenerating health. There are games that do it well. I actually thought the first Halo did regenerating health really well, because you could tell that if you still had some shield when you ducked behind cover, it would regenerate quite a bit faster than if you had to do the whole thing. There was like a bit of recycle time before it would recharge. And I thought that was a nice way to try to set it up. Of course, most games don't do that as well. The other thing is original Halo, good old OG Halo.
I can't believe you just said that.
Oh, hell yeah. OG Halo had, you know, when you got shot, even when your shields were gone, the screen wasn't completely useless. There was a bit of red flashing, but you were, you know, you could still fight and like, or run away to cover or whatever. You weren't sitting there with like a basically a black and red screen that's unusable because it looks like somebody painted your television set. It's, you know, I can still see what's going on and I can see that there's cover over there and I should get to that cover now. So
yeah,
that was a game that did regenerating well. Unsurprisingly, most of the people that copied it completely missed the point and copied all of the wrong things.
And there you have it. We've got about a 5-minute guns topic for you. I have in front of me here John's Glock, and it's a good illustration of what we're going to be talking about, at least to begin with. What we're going to be talking about tonight, to wrap up the evening, is ergonomic features that people make a big deal about, which aren't really all that big a deal.
Nope.
Now, they may be a big deal for you, an individual shooter, but on the whole, they are matters of taste and not matters of good or bad.
Exactly. Subjective, not objective.
Right. So, of course, with the Glock in hand, if you're a firearms person, you'll be seeing, you may see this one coming. We're going to be talking about grip angle to kick things off. Now, I will once again verify that this is not a loaded Glock, although I was the last person to hold it, so I don't think I really, you know, necessarily need to. But
we need to appease the safety Nazis.
Good habits.
Yep.
So, yeah, I will hold it. I'll close my eyes and hold it out in front of me. And it turns out that I am, in fact, pointing it, like 10 degrees higher than I thought it was. Yep. And this is the problem that people tend to say they have with the Glock grip angle. But, that said, we who do not necessarily like the Glock grip angle are not the sole arbiters of what is an acceptable grip angle. And I believe John has a little anecdote to
Sure. So, you know, one, grip angle, for some people, the Glock doesn't work. Some people really like it. The Gaston Glock's engineering team designed it after the German Luger pistol. They copied that because that was the European firearm that they figured everybody was familiar with and liked. Everyone likes Lugers. And again, it works for a lot of people. It doesn't work for a lot of people. Just like revolvers, a bunch of other guns. Some things work for you, some things don't. Here's another one. So I like Glocks. I don't know if I like the grip angle or if I've just gotten used to it. Since I do my press outs with my eyes open, the sights appear where they want them to be aligned, and it's never been an issue for me. But 1911s aren't an issue for me, or Jay's Beretta isn't an issue for me. I haven't found the press out and how the gun points to be a big problem unless my eyes are closed, which isn't really a combat thing. And let's talk also about some people who shoot with the Glock professionally, like Bob Vogel. Professional shooter, USPSA champion, he's amazingly fast. And he likes Glocks because of the grip angle. Not because of how they point for him, but because the grip angle lets him get a really high aggressive grip on the gun and control recoil really well. His grip management technique is really pretty cool, and it takes advantage of the way the Glock is set up to work a little better with that platform. So, I don't know how it points for Bob. I've never had a chance to ask him. One of these days I probably will. But until then, you know, it doesn't really matter for him. It gives him the recoil control, and he can just correct it as he presses it out if he has a problem. Or he'll get used to it. See, if you're issued the gun, you'll make do. And this is true for any of the guns we're going to talk about, not just the Glock.
Yeah. Which brings us, I believe, to our second point.
Yep.
Safeties. Should they be there? Should they be slide-mounted? Should they be frame-mounted? Now, I am, of course, a Beretta shooter. Yep. Not like a professional one, obviously, because I'm not that good a shooter.
But he's not cool enough yet.
If I were, I would want to be a Beretta shooter. And I like my safeties, correspondingly, on the slide. People say, this is terrible. How could you possibly like your safeties on the slide? And I find it's not a problem. I have got fairly short thumbs, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, so you have short thumbs.
Not super long. And yet, I find that the safety is the least of my problems as far as reaching controls go. The magazine release is much harder.
He uses that a lot more often,
yeah, exactly.
Frankly.
The safety is easy to hit with my thumb going forward as I'm taking my grip after having removed the gun from my holster. And that's really all I feel I need to say about that.
Yep.
John probably has
anything.
I mean, John's, I suppose, a no-safety guy, generally.
Right. Well, I mean, like, what's in this box here, Jay? So in front of me, I have a box, a gun box, in fact, and in it is my brand new SIG pistol. And it's a P320. It does not have any external manual safeties. I happen to prefer that. I'm a big striker-fired guy. Usually the trigger is kind of a vaguely double-action only sort of kind of, not really-ish.
Well, that sort of feel, at least.
Yeah.
You don't have a super crisp, super short break. No. You have a little bit of roll to it.
Right. It's not like a tuned 1911 trigger. And so since it has some roll, since it's got some weight to it, I say, all right, you know, I don't want a safety. I'm just going to trust myself to maintain good trigger discipline and train for that. And then when I draw the gun, I don't have to do anything. And when I come off target, I don't have to do anything. And that's, I think, the only, like, when I look at this problem, and this is not what people say, mind you, but when I look at the problem, the only thing I might possibly have a problem with the slide-mounted safety is if I'm reactivating it a lot with doing a lot of on and off target transitions. But I can probably work around that with just using my offhand for that. It's something that if I was issued a Beretta, I would get used to. If I really like the Beretta for other reasons, I can work around it.
Hi.
And if I don't like it, you know what I can do? Buy a different gun, like I just did.
Yep.
Or like a 1911, which has a frame-mounted safety, which I always found intuitive to take off because it's just kind of under your thumb when it falls on the slide and you get pressed down a bit. And then your weak-hand thumb can push it up. It's a little easier to get back on quickly. But again, if I'm coming off target and it takes a little longer for me to safe my gun, I don't care. I'm coming off target. It's like reholstering. There's no prize for getting your gun back in the holster the fastest. The prize was for shooting the bad guy in his stupid face. Right? So if it's a little awkward to put it back on, okay, whatever, I'll deal. You know, as long as you can get it off, that's the big thing. And Jay, with his short thumbs, who has a little bit of trouble releasing a non-extended magazine catch, can still hit that safety okay. So really, again, this is overblown. And I would also like to point out that while that's a nicely analyzed problem, that's never what anyone on the stupid internet forums actually says their problem is.
Right.
If that was their problem, then I would understand, sort of. I mean, okay, you can deal with it or just not buy one. And it's not an objectively bad gun, it's just subjectively not your choice. But that's not what anyone says.
It's objectively bad, it's terrible. I can't believe you would ever buy one of those.
Yep, exactly. It's a stupid gun with a stupid safety that totally sucks because nobody can reach it. No, it's not that bad. Like, you have to be a really small-handed person to not reach it, and you'll probably have other problems that you'll notice first.
Like, say, reaching the magazine catch.
Right, or the trigger in double action mode.
Yeah.
Or, gee, this gun is massively too big for my hands. It's like holding an 8x8. Maybe I should get a different gun, Jay.
A smaller one of some sort, perhaps.
Huh, smaller gun. So, that's a classic one. You want to bring up another one? Or is it my turn?
It's yours. I didn't have any other ones prepared, really.
Okay, here's another one. Charging handles. And I'm going to keep it general. But basically, anywhere you put a charging handle on a gun, someone's going to find a reason why it's stupid.
And to be fair, anywhere you put a charging handle on a gun, it's going to be annoying for some reason.
Yep. Now, I'm a big AR-15 shooter. The AR-15 charging handle isn't ideal because when I rack it, if my face is kind of in that cheek weld, ready to shoot position, I'm going to hit myself in the nose with the charging handle.
But, the chin, or, you know, catch it in...
Yeah, the chin,
for me,
or
catch it in my beard.
The face, yeah. Right. Yeah, no, it's going to hit me in the face. I'm not going to like it. But here's the thing. The design of the AR... One, I'm not running the charging handle all that often on an AR-15.
Sure, it's designed so you don't have to.
Right, it has a last round bolt hole open. I use that all the freaking time. I just slap the side of the gun and, oh, wait. Oh, I chambered around, I can keep shooting. I don't need to work the charging handle. And then it's out of my way of, like, optics and stuff. I also own a SCAR. A SCAR has a reciprocating charging handle. Now, I've noticed with some optics, you might want to pick a bigger charging handle or choose how you mount your charging handle on the optic levers so you don't whack your knuckles on the optic. But again, that's a choice thing based on the optic and mount and the charging handle choice and side. You can switch sides with that. And again, there's aftermarket options available. Some people have said... Now, everybody knows you can work around that. You just go slow and, you know, practice or wear a glove. But people have said, oh, I've whacked my hand on the charging handle and made the gun short stroke, and I don't know how they were holding the gun. And I've never actually seen one of these morons who's claimed that they've hit their hand on the charging handle. None of these short bus morons can actually show me a picture of how were you holding the gun when this happened. Show me a picture so I know you're not making stuff up. But apparently they're doing like the ultimate weird C-clamp grip where your wrist
wraparound
is on the other side of the gun and your forearm is right next to the big reciprocating thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I think if you really shot the gun, you'd learn not to do that pretty quick because I'd imagine it hurts.
Precisely.
Hey, Jay, you know what other gun has a stupid charging handle?
What's that?
That AK you like. It's a stupid charging handle.
It's true. It's not a great charging handle. And unlike the AR, you've got to use it a fair bit. But at the same time, it's not really all that much slower once you get used to it.
No.
I mean, the more annoying thing changing an AK magazine is the magazine catch and release system.
The
rocket lock sort of thing. That's a pain. That's legitimately a pain. I think I would even agree that's kind of a pain. But I don't think the charging handle is that big a deal, because if you're looking at your reload like you're probably going to be doing, you've got the gun a little bit tilted already, just tilt it a little bit further, and grab that charging handle with your hand under the gun, and pull it, and you're done. That's all there is to it. It's not great, but it's certainly usable. It's not as big a deal as you're making it out to be, random internet person number 37.
Who probably... If you were talking about your three-gun, I might understand. But here's the thing. I can have a gun for three-gun and a bunch of other guns that I still like and enjoy shooting,
yeah,
but I just don't take a three-gun.
We've talked about this before. How often do you reload in three-gun anyway?
Yeah, not that often.
Yeah. Just get one of those, shoot an unlimited, get one of the big 75-round drums.
Get a bigger mag.
Yeah.
Or, you know, shoot something else with three-gun, but you can still have AKs and like AKs and just deal with, you know, the fact that your reload's a little slower. Okay, that's life. And again, even if you think it's a big deal for you, which it probably only is if, you know, you're a serious sponsored three-gun competitor, in which case you're not even picking what you shoot anyway, it's not a big deal. Nobody cares.
It's not. It's not a big deal.
Yep. Yep. But no, it's not. And it's certainly not a, you know, objectively bad thing. But there's no winning with charging handles. They all suck.
This is the truth.
Yep.
I believe that about wraps us up.
Oh, wait. No. No, there's not. There's one more. So one of the other guns I own, I do own Glocks. I like them. I own an HK VP9. I like that a lot. One of the things, it shoots really well and the ergonomics are second to none. They really did a cool job with the interchangeable backstrap and side panels. It's got a great trigger. Recoil's very soft. To release the magazines, there are little paddles on the back of the trigger guard, one on each side. And you press down on the paddle and the magazine drops free. Now, this is not a button. Pretty self-evidently, it's not a button, which gets a lot of people's panties in a bunch. It's different. Now, I know a bunch of people who say the paddles are actually faster once you practice a little bit. And they're completely ambidextrous, and they work better than the ambidextrous button. And, hey, Jay, can you reach the paddles on my VP9?
I can.
Oh, you can. Can you reach them on your Beretta M9?
Not easily.
How about you know, on most other guns you try?
It depends on the gun, but...
How about that Glock in front of you? Can you reach the magazine release easily?
Yes.
No, there you go. See, that's a nice extended button, though. If it wasn't so fat, I think you'd have some problems.
Yeah, I could see that being the case. I don't know which way the extension's going. Like how much I'm getting out of that. But yes, generally speaking, I do need a little bit of extension. And I don't on the VP9.
It's really cool.
Out of the box because it's a paddle and it's not a little button I've got to reach to press.
Exactly. I also really like the option of pressing it with your thumb or, you know, your trigger or middle finger, depending on how your hand is shaped.
Yeah.
And if you end up using your other hand or giving it to a left-handed shooter, or if a left-handed shooter picks it up out of the box because they wanted to buy one,
it's very straightforward.
You don't have to do anything. Yeah. Swapping...
Look, it's already ambidextrous. Yep. Bam, done.
Exactly. I can go shoot. Swapping a trigger release is never not a pain. It is always stupid. That stupid little mag catch is always a massive pain.
Well, if you picture what it is internally, it's a button that's held in, that's got to push against a spring but still be retained in the frame of the gun. And that's,
by that spring.
Yeah, and that's always going to be a terrible thing to replace because you've got to press that spring in
when you're trying to unhook it like a dental hook or a screwdriver and curse a lot and gouge up the inside. It's terrible. The paddles are really cool. I really like them. I think they're pretty intuitive to use once you'd like look at the thing for 2 minutes. Also, reports from some cop friends of mine whose departments have switched from to the VP9 or other HKs have said it's not a problem. I know a friend on the Border Patrol, they use HKs. And again, that paddle is not a problem. It's super easy. It's actually easy once you get past the, oh my God, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but again, if it really bothers you that much, buy a different gun.
Yep.
But that doesn't make the VP9 an objectively bad gun because you can't get over they changed one thing from John Moses Browning's designs.
I think that really, that is a good capstone to this segment, which is to say, if you don't like it, buy a different gun. We live in a wonderful country where you can do that.
Yep.
You've got this entire enormous market whose sole purpose is to fill your preferences, you, the consumer, to make you happy with what you buy.
And you have lots of choices for guns. And, you know, we love to debate which gun is the best and which gun we would pick for fighting hordes of zombie ninjas that are accompanied by Nazi robot
pirates,
mecha pirate riders. But, you know, whatever. But the point is, really, if you walk into a gun store and you look at the case, frankly, if you had a chimp run down a 9mm gun and throw one at you and said, here, you're going to use this, you probably can't go wrong. Just be sure to duck or catch that, because otherwise that's going to hurt.
Yeah, it's kind of heavy.
The chimp is going to hit you in the face with that, and you'll have a weird gun-shaped imprint. It'll be funny, but
on
not
that
for you.
Chimp-related bombshell, I think it's time to wrap up.
I think so. I think we've covered this.
You have wasted more than an hour again with us tonight. I hope you found the audio setup acceptable, even with John's predictable loudness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Someday I'll learn that I'm not shooting over a machine gun, shouting over a machine gun team. But today is not that day.
I had hoped I would have some way of making his monitoring much louder than mine, so I could crank his headphone volume up all the way, so he thinks, oh, I'm talking, so I should be maybe a little bit quieter, possibly. And
no.
Well, I'm just sitting here with the normal monitoring volume, so I can hear and pay attention in all the normal ways. But alas, it is not to be, and I think that is probably a bridge too far until we. Break down, until we get sponsored, then break down and buy an actual mixing board.
Right. damn you, John Frost. You couldn't take that bridge in Arnhem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, well, good night, everybody. We'd like to thank you for listening to us. This episode of the Crossbox Podcast is brought to you by Jay's new novella, Nathaniel Cannon, The Lost City of P2. Find it wherever ebooks are sold or at manywords.press/books. The Crossbox Podcast is produced by my co-host,
Jay,
and myself, John, and it's brought to you by Many Words Press. Online at manywords.press. Our theme music is Royal Rumble by J-Man of rmusicbox.com. Thank you, J-Man. And is used under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution License. Keep up with us, the Crossbox contributors, between podcasts at soapbox.manywords.press.